I gotta record. Whoops, sorry.
Oh, okay. No worries.
No, it's recording. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm just gonna get this out of the way because I waxed hyperbolically sentimental about what this means to me and like what your work has meant to me, but I really don't think I can overemphasize what listening to your program and reading your thoughts has really meant to sort of the way that I think. I mean, you know, these ideas that you have about combining art into this whole thing as well really resonate with me. And I think that, between your thoughts and Paul Kimball's thoughts, they really have they're the sort of things that I get really jazzed about when I think about these sort of topics. So just that's my fanboying. I'm just going to go ahead and get right out of the way.
Well, that's fine. You're totally welcome. A lot of these,
as a lot of people know, a lot of these thoughts are not unique to you or I or anybody
right.
else you mentioned. We just kind of took people that we're interested in, reiterated what they said, and then try to say something a little bit to push it a little bit further, which I think you did in your book.
Well,
there we
saying
go.
Something new. It's just trying to articulate it in a different manner, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's new to some people. And then I read some things and people say, there's this great new thing. It's like, no, somebody was talking about that in 1967. Sometimes they were talking about it in the late 40s or early 50s. So,
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess almost nothing's new.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all about just trying to find ways to synthesize these old ideas and maybe graft on, new evidence, as it were, for certain thoughts and certain theories. I know we had a sort of brief exchange, or you on Facebook about Patrick Harper's Daimonic Reality. Have you read that?
No, people keep telling me to read it, and I haven't read
it. Well, the thing that I find really striking about it is that there's such a strong internal consistency in his model, but it is like full on in this gray area that he deals with, and the way that he it's so funny because it's one of those books that says a lot of things that I've been trying to say, and at the same time it I would run across things and. I've run across things in that particular book where it would bring up something that I thought that no one had really looked at. Oh, no, he's actually looked at it. It was kind of funny. I actually read this book after I wrote mine, and he has a section in there dedicated to supernatural food, and we arrived at the same conclusions, but I was like, dang it. I wish I'd seen this about 6 months ago.
Yeah, so, yeah. Well, that happens a lot, too. I mean, it happens to me, and... a lot of people I know. Probably I should play the intro. You know what? I had a new intro I made up, and I don't have it with me. Damn it. But before I post it, I'll put the new intro on. It has quotes from John Keel, audio quotes. John Keel, Jacques Vallée, Mac Tonies, and William Burroughs before it even goes into the intro.
That is awesome. That is awesome. I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah. Well, you can't hear it now, but when I post the show, you'll be able to hear it. We had a nice cold opening there, but here we go with this.
Alrighty.
No, the whole extraterrestrial thing is not a viable solution to this.
We need to go through a turning point in the study of this whole domain, away from ideology. We're not here to prove that we're being visited by aliens from this planet or that star. That may very well be true, but we have not done the basic work.
I have this hunch that this phenomenon is comes from some sort of domain of pure information, and the fact that it can interact with us at all suggests that that we inhabit a domain that's also pure information.
Are we go conditioned here? Yes.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, Future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
Yes, I'm gradually evolving that intro it into something different. But well, since we had a big bumper in there, we'll go on. I'm sorry. This is my guest is Joshua Cutchin, who wrote this wonderful book, A Trojan Feast, which I brought a copy of. I have my questions. And what were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say, I hope that there's some vestigial DNA of this original intro and the new intro, because I do
know
so
the
many
same
things about it. Okay.
It's the same. I just tacked on at the beginning. Kiel Vallee, Mac Tonys, and William Burroughs. Actually, all William Burroughs says is, are we in a go condition here? Yes. And then it goes into the...
Perfect. That's great. It wouldn't be the same otherwise. So.
Yeah, and it's been the same opening for a while.
I would encourage you to feel free to veer away from the plan at any and every juncture, because it's kind of funny. I said this exact same thing when I was talking to Tim Bunnall. Like, half of me wrote this book because I had things to say, and half of me wrote it just to have an excuse to talk to people like you. So
yeah, well, that's why my friends and I started that magazine in the 90s, because I wanted to have an excuse to talk to people.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and the little ticket into that was having to write about it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's easier now than ever to get people's ears and to say, hey, but I feel like to be able, actually be able to bring something to the table and be like, hey, look, here's something, I've put some thought into this. Now can we talk about something else? is another good way to do it too.
Yeah,
so
that's exactly why I did such things.
Nice.
It's like, oh, well, maybe eventually I can talk to these people, one, about things that they've written and done, or ideas that have influenced me, and two, maybe they'll become friends and I can call them up whenever. And that happened many times, and it was great. I mean, I feel about Robert Anton Wilson probably 10 times the way you just said at the beginning of the show. And I got to the point where I could call him up, he'd talk to me. And that was a miracle to me. It's like, why should he even be talking to me? There's no reason for this guy to be talking to me.
Yeah, and that's such a crazy feeling, is when you sort of – I mean, there's nothing more surreal than to have these sort of – interactions with people that you looked up towards. I mean, I talked to Micah about this when we last got together. I grew up with this copy of Jerome Clark's Unexplained.
Yeah.
And like my mom had to like slap packing tape on it growing up as a kid. and it's bizarre because he reviewed my book and he liked it. Like, it's just crazy. And then, I've been fortunate enough in like a lot of musical areas to have interactions with people that I looked up towards, and it's you do really realize that people put on their pants one leg at a time, I guess.
Yeah, well, that, and when they start talking to you, you realize, oh, okay. After a while, you think, well, maybe I am like slightly worthy, and maybe I can go ahead. It's like, it's encouragement. If this person will talk to me, maybe I'm not as bad as I thought.
Exactly. Yeah.
Maybe they're not just being nice, because they will answer back, and then I say, can I call you sometime or whatever? They just hand me their phone number. It's like, wow, okay, that's wonderful. And I will call you, so we'll see.
And you know what? It's really interesting. Like, I would say
it's continuing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I would say, like, so far in this area, I haven't met any pricks. But, I would say even in the music area, whenever I've met people, like, I would say maybe 10% of them actually turn out to be, divas, or turn out to be self-important.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's the same in anything. It's a very small percentage. But the thing is, it's kind of like where you think that a group that is the loudest represents that group. It doesn't. It's the group that's the most either passionate or crazy, and probably both. And yeah. So then everybody says, well, that's what kind of person is into that. Like,
yeah, it's almost like an inverse of Sturgeon's Law, you know?
Yes, yes.
90% of everybody is decent.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would revise the Sturgeon's Law to about 95 to 98% of everything is crap.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it happens as you get older. You're just kind of like, I get less and less patient with stuff, and that's just a normal thing that happens.
It's well, like, and
come
with
on,
the
get to the point,
too.
You know.
Oh, sorry, I'm sort of stepping on you because it's I think okay. There's a little bit of a lag every
that's
now.
What,
and
that's what this show's about.
but you know, also with the addendum that everything starts to suck after a while. Like you can only ride a wave for so long. I'm a big fan of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it's been great, and I think it's still kind of great, but at some point it's going to start being awful. So, you know, it's this idea of tending towards entropy even with everything will, you know. I can't think of anybody who really is able to nail the follow through on you know, producing media of any type. So
no, not really. It seems like, and I think I've whined about this before somewhere, as soon as somebody knows what they're doing or there's a formula, it's almost not worth paying attention to anymore, because yeah, they aren't searching at that point. They aren't thinking about it. They go on autopilot, and then you can tell they're on autopilot because it's not interesting anymore.
Yeah, exactly. There's a great quote from Tom Waits talking about how, you know, your hands are like dogs and they always go to the same old places that they've been. So you've always got to try something new.
That's true. I mean, I don't know what I'm doing with this show. You know, besides having, you know, great people on, as I try to have that happen every time.
Yeah.
There's one guy that Bruce Duensing told me about. I started reading his stuff. I wanted to talk to him. I composed an email, then got nervous because I didn't know if I knew I was saying anything. And now he's written a book and he's on all these shows and people saying, Greg, why haven't you talked to this guy yet? It's like, I knew about him like 9 months ago and I didn't do anything. That's why.
I'm trying to think if I can figure out who you're talking about.
Binal had him on. Eric Ouye, I think his name is.
When did he have him on? Just recently, or
yeah, I think it was the last show because he just sent me.
Okay.
He sent me a note saying, "Greg, you got to have this guy on. He's so amazing. I think you'd dig him." It's like,
got it.
I know I dig him. I already read like 5 of his papers. Damn it.
that makes sense because I haven't caught up from all my listening. I was at the beach this past week, so I haven't caught up on all that. So that's okay. That makes sense. I've downloaded it and it's on my iPod. I just haven't listened to it yet.
Yeah, maybe I should listen to it. But well, no, I should just get in contact with Eric and say, hey, you want to come on the show? Because, you know, I'll have the same people on as Tim or somebody else. But, you know, my style is different than theirs. And then I do things like, and people will, if you can still do this, I asked Joshua if he'd play the tuba for us at the end of the show because he's a professional musician and that's what he plays.
yeah, it's kind of funny. I was talking with one of the guys in my band the other day, and I'm like, it's really interesting because all of my music friends are like, what the hell's up with this UFO stuff? And all the UFO people are like, what the hell's up with the tuba? So I feel like I've got something to talk about everywhere
well,
I go.
They're not well-rounded people then.
I know. Everybody should know about the tuba, right?
They should. I know about it. I know the difference between the tuba and the sousaphone.
No way, really, because that's, man, you're doing, my wife even gets the two mixed up from time to time.
Well, the sousaphone's slightly smaller, right?
The sousaphone's the one that you wear.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
and it was
yeah.
invented by John Philip Sousa so he could have it in the orchestra when they were marching.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and actually it was, you know, the original sort of, well, we're in deep cuts, folks. We're into tuba history right here
on
Radio Mysterious.
Oh, who cares? We'll get to the stuff.
You know, actually the Helicon, not the Helicon of old, which was a worn sort of instrument like that, but there was also a marching tuba that was used in the Civil War that was called a Helicon.
Ah.
And basically the only thing that Sousa really did was he chopped the bell off so that it could detach and you could, you know, throw it in your throw it in a case, basically, is all. But he gets all the credit for it being a sousaphone.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
See, I didn't know that. See, he's stealing stuff. Edison, everybody. Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, it's an, you don't choose to play the tuba. You just sort of wind up doing it.
I have to send. Do you know about the reason I know this is because of the radio personality Gene Shepherd, who's one of my favorite audio radio type hosts ever. Mm-hmm. He played the sousaphone in high school. He wrote the Christmas story, the one that's on every Christmas.
He has a great essay about playing the tuba that actually.
He says it plays you if you're not careful.
Yeah, exactly. It's something like tubas are like ornery horses. And each one is different, which, you know, even to this day, there's a pretty wide variety between horns. You sort of have to look for it, you know, for the one that fits your personality.
Do you want me to read the thing off the back of the book, or do you want to introduce yourself and tell? Yeah, I'll read the thing off the back of the book like a lazy radio host.
Okay, that works.
Native of North. This is my guest, Joshua Cutchin. He wrote a book, an interesting book, a fun book, which as you read it, it gets like. It's like a movie. It gets more interesting as you go on until it reaches a wonderful crescendo at the end. That is not on the back of the book.
Well, I appreciate it.
On the back of the book, it says that my guest, Joshua Cutchin, is a native of North Carolina with a long interest in Fortiana. He holds a master's in music literature and a master's in journalism, which we'll talk to you about because the book sounds a little academic at times, from the University of Georgia and currently works as a public affairs specialist in the Southeast. In addition to his media work, Cutchin is also a published composer and maintains an active performing schedule as a jazz and rock tuba player, having appeared on 8 albums and live concerts DVDs. Trojan Feast is his first book, and I may add, I hope not the last one.
Well, thank you, Greg. That really does mean a lot. You're talking about the structure of it. You know, I really wanted it to be something that, like, it could be your first book on this sort of subject on esoterica, or it could be your 101st. Is sort of the way that I wanted to structure it. So, right. You know, Mom, you can read this. You know, or you know, Greg, you can read this. You know, you'll both get something out of it. So,
Yes, I did. And, you know, some of the drug stuff I skipped over because, like, DMT. Okay, I know about it. Rick Strassman. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Okay, let's get to what Josh was saying about it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just one of those necessary evils.
Project Beta was like that, too. There was probably a third of it is I didn't really want to put that in there. But since it was for a wide audience, I wanted to put it in there. And Patrick, who I think is your editor, too, kind of suggested that I write it like a story.
So yeah, that yeah. I mean, too. Patrick does a really good job of being aware of what people outside of these fields are not aware of.
Right.
Yeah. And he's been a prince of a human being to work with. I have nothing but great things to say about Patrick.
Me either. Or me too. The one thing I'll say about Patrick is I turned in the book, the manuscript, and he said, "Put this chapter after this one and change this line here." That's it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the other thing is like, it's a lot like music in the way that like, sometimes you just need to know when to get out of your own way or when to let something just go or, you know, when to leave space in your solo, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That is true. I once wrote a, editorial for the magazine and I said, putting the magazine together is like producing a record album. You got all these tracks, which are the articles. You mix them, meaning you put them in, you know, some kind of order and an introduction in a way that makes logical sense, at least to somebody. And you present it in a way that the most people will, or at least the most people that are into that kind of stuff, will enjoy and understand it.
You know, it's interesting. Something I've thought about, and I haven't talked really with anybody about this, but I've started to, because I end up listening, before I quit my job in June, or July, rather. I had an hour long commute to and from work, and
that's when people do their listening.
Yeah, jeez, yeah. So it's a lot of opportunities for me to listen to stuff, and you know, so I ended up listening. I ended up a habit of like listening to like literally 11 podcasts a week. But what I found to be really interesting to me is how the different ones that I listen to tend to have different vibes, almost like genres of music. Like, I love Mysterious Universe, but in a lot of ways, it's like pop music because it's accessible and it's well produced, and you know, anybody can enjoy it.
Yeah.
The Paracast, it's like classical music. You got to have some background on the subjects. They're not going to walk you through what Cash Landrum was, you know?
Right.
And it's funny, Radio Mysterioso, I feel is like it's like a bop jam session because. you know, you've, again, it's not one of those things where they're going to walk you through stuff. New ideas, strange ideas, it's fine, come to the table, but you've got to have a pretty good working knowledge, I feel like, to hang with and to get everything out of this program. And that's why I sort of like it, because it's like this free but in-depth, closely focused look at this stuff. And that's part of the reason that I kind of bugged you about putting up more, or no, I bugged Red Pill Junkie. I was like, man, I really wish Greg would put everything up that he can, because I love it so much.
Well, I try to, and actually I've been posting stuff a little bit more regularly than I used to, because I haven't had a job since like February. So it's a lot easier for me to get the important things done, like this show. The Walter Bosley show from a couple weeks ago is still being messed with. I don't have to do too much messing with some of these things. As this one, I hear nothing that we've said so far that I have to edit, or usually it's me. You know what my editing people think? Oh, you're editing all this great stuff. It's like, no, I'm editing out me going, and these exactly. Big long pauses. That's 99% of what I'm editing out. And then every once in a while I'll say something I really don't want to repeat. That's about it.
Yeah. Every now and then I have to, I almost have one of those moments, just a minute ago. Is I was searching for what my line of thought was, but you know, if you know, I just
it's about a second, I don't care. But if I get like pieces where I or the guest isn't saying something, or 3, 4, 5, 10 seconds, I cut that out.
Well, that's like any conversation is going to have those, you know, those lulls.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
When we're doing something longer form like this, it's inevitable. You
know, of course it is. So what I do is I just look at the waveform on there, and if I see a space, I just zoom into it. And then I generally just go through the – people don't know this. I was going to do this one time on the show, is just show people how I edit by editing live on the air. It's like, look, here's the show we did last week. This is what I'm doing to it. And I basically listen to bits and pieces of it. And like, oh, yeah, we were saying that there. Yeah, we were saying that there. If there's something really important, I will make a note of it during the show. Like I'll type it into my computer or on the pad or something. And then I'll address it at the time. Like, you know, Paul Kimball's that laugh coming in. During while we were talking, I was like, I wrote that down so I'd know where to look for it.
That was quite unique.
Yeah, totally not planned, of course, and because you know the first thing I thought was, well, you know, maybe it was just a bleed through from somewhere. It's like, why at that particular exact time though?
yeah, no, exactly.
So somebody hoaxed us, or it's something truly mysterious and weird.
Or there's an outside chance that it's completely coincidental.
Yes, yeah. There is a chance of that too.
But you know, you go so far. Well, this is the whole problem that I have with mainstream science and this sort of subjects, is that like, yes, these things can be accounted for by chance, but when you have something that is so ridiculously, synchronistic, and there's some degree of consistency to it, then it's probably not chance.
Yeah, well, and the other part of that is, and I'm going over a bunch of my old things I wrote. Maybe I'll say something about it. I'm trying to put together a collection of my writing for publication.
Nice. Is it going to be some of the old UFO mystic stuff? Or
yeah, a lot of that, and a bunch of stuff people have never seen because it never got published.
Nice.
Including a piece I wrote about how much I hate the movie Armageddon.
I love that. Just out of nowhere.
Yes, it was a contest. Yeah, it was a contest, and I won the contest by ranting about how much I hated the movie Armageddon. I read it live on stage. It's just, you know, it was called an op-ed slam. And
nice.
It's like, what are you going to do for that? So it's like, well, I hate that movie. Maybe I'll write something about it. And then before I went down there, I listened to Bill Hicks for an hour.
get all fired up.
Yes.
That's perfect.
Anyway, Joshua wrote a book that we should probably talk about.
at some point. Hey, you know, it's like I said, I'm just glad to be here. So and you're going off of your plan. So that gives me good hope. Because you know, I've been listening to you, and you've always said stuff like, you know, that whenever somebody wants to come on to promote something, it's like, well, you bristle at that a little bit. And I totally get that. I'm like, please don't think that's what I'm doing.
Well, if I looked at the book and I thought it was junk, or I wasn't interested, or it was, you know, a dumb book, then I probably wouldn't have answered you or just said, look, maybe sometime. But if I think that, You know, I've said this before, and you know this. I'm very selfish about this show. I'm not getting paid for it. I'm coming in on my time to do it. It's because I want to. And
yeah,
it's because
yeah.
I'm doing something because I want to. It means I better have a good reason for it. And the reason is I get to talk to people. I get to learn stuff. And my, you know, the only way, you know, it's like the writing. The only thing I have to do for it is put it up so people can,
yeah.
other people can hear it.
Yeah.
Because I'd like to. I don't mind talking people one on one. It doesn't bother me at all. It's nice. In fact, some people I've said I want to do the interview and they go, I'd rather just talk to you privately. I go, okay, that's fine. But most people say, yeah, I'll do the show. And
yeah.
it's because it's, you know, something is being communicated and something is being learned and something new is happening. Somebody said, why don't you interview Rich Dolan? It's like, I did a little bit and I don't want to interview him because I don't want him to talk about all the stuff he talks about on every other show because that's what he's going to do. That's his shtick. That's fine.
Right. Right.
I do want to have him on and talk about his interest in 19th century baseball, about his specialization in history.
Exactly.
Yeah, just stuff like that. I mean, it's like, you know, what kind of music do you like? Why? You know, what was it like growing up? What are your brothers and sisters? Just stuff that he... There, you got the siren.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it's going a different direction than normal. It's actually going north-south. It usually goes east-west. Not that you can tell on the phone. Anyway, but that's why, you know, I would like to talk to him about that stuff because you're never going to hear that anywhere else. That interests me. If you want to know about what he's writing about or what his thing is or what the disclosure thing is with him, listen to any number of 500 other shows.
Yeah. And, you know, it's sometimes I wonder, sort of keeping in line with these out of the box ideas that I really like. I wonder if part of the reason two things that I've wondered, do paranormal supernatural events just exist to make everybody look like an idiot? The materialists and the non-materialists, non-materialists, you know, just enough evidence to make the materialists look like fools, not enough evidence to make the people who are interested in these things look like fools. But also, like, is it maybe just some sort of facilitator for getting people, you know, together, you know? Some sort of creation of opportunity for people who normally wouldn't be able to connect, you know?
Yeah. Weirdo dating, cosmic weirdo dating service.
Yeah, it's cosmic weirdo dating school, yeah.
Yeah. Dating service.
Yahoo
personals for weirdos. I met my wife on Yahoo personals, strangely enough.
Nice. I met my wife online too. So.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's I've just at the beginning of that wave, I guess. I don't know. There is a book that we should talk about.
We should.
A Trojan Feast. Let me read the subtitle. The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch. Now, if that's not a title to get people to read a book, I don't know what is. It's a great title.
No elevator pitch for this book. You know, no like two-sentence thing that really conveys why this is something worth looking at, I don't think. You know, because it's not about the diet of these creatures. I mean, you have to talk about it a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's not about, you know, it's not even about like, I found some, it's not about manna from heaven, even though you have to talk about that a little bit. It's specifically the act of offering. And to get people to realize why that is something worth talking about, you have to spend some background on like, you know, the Celtic folklore. And it's been really hard to get people to understand like in the real world, quote unquote, and to get them to understand why this is something, why this is an area which needs to be looked into, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's like one of my first questions. Why did you write the book? How did you like come to think, okay, this is something that hasn't been talked about and I think I can do it.
Well, you know, it's just something that I'd always noticed and I'd always been fascinated with the connections between fairy folk and aliens and whatnot. Hilariously enough, Greg, until I started doing the research for this book, I was like vividly terrified of the abduction scenario, like irrationally terrified for a 28-year-old man.
I was too when I was reading Bud Hopkins' books. You know how scared I was driving home at 1 a.m. in Topanga Canyon in Los Angeles, way outside of town where there were tons of UFO sightings. I was terrified, like an idiot. But yes,
we must be abductees, Greg. It's the only explanation. I always found that hilarious when people say that because, like, it could be Teddy Ruxpin breaking into my room at 3 a.m. and it would terrify me. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Well, anything.
Irrationally concerned about it, and in a way, seeing these like broader folk for whatever reason, thinking that they're fairy folk, even if they do the same thing that they do, thinking that they're fairy folk or that they're more of this sort of loosey goosey, non nuts and bolts sort of entities, really kind of helped me get over that. And this is something that I really haven't talked about on many other podcasts.
Good.
Because, exactly. Well, you know, I have my patent answer, which that's all building up to the patent answer, is that I've always found interest in this stuff. I had an Amazon gift card. I bought J. Robert Alley's Raincoast Sasquatch, which is about Sasquatch sightings in Alaska. And right there, smack dab, in the beginning of the book, it talks about the Native Americans feeling that if you were to take food from Sasquatch, you would be trapped with Sasquatch forever.
Yeah.
Which is something that I hadn't heard before. But also ties into this, ties into the fairy folklore, obviously, with that Celtic belief that if the fairies gave you food, you'd be trapped with the fairies forever. And, you know, you also have this other motif of that nobody had really talked about, of food and drink being given in abduction accounts. And I just, it just struck me as something that was too consistent and too odd because, I mean, it's not, as I've said numerous times, like, these are a lot of times not encounters where somebody has to be given something to sustain them. Like, you could go through a 4-hour abduction experience and not need anything to drink or eat. You know, that being said, I also have had a lot of interest in theory of everything sort of ideas. You know, again, this is not me saying that all aliens are fairies and that all Sasquatch are aliens. And it's not that. It's just to me, I find it, There are things in common that if you deny and you write off, then you're just not paying attention to the data. And I've always found trying to parse out what that could mean to be really interesting. One of the most fascinating things, because I think that if we really can dig down and focus on some of this common minutia, we might be able to have something that reveals itself about the phenomena in a really profound way. You know, the phrase that I use at the end of the book is, "What we're not seeing the trees for the forest." You know, we're always trying to solve the big question instead of really nailing down and drilling down on some little questions. So, at the same time, I was listening to you become more and more exasperated with the UFO field, rightly so. But that was sort of a lot of the impetus for me in this book and moving forward. To look at quote unquote the unimportant, because I think that's in some ways the place where I feel like we will see the most headway, is by looking at these tiny things that people have thought to be inconsequential and really trying to see if they tell us anything about the phenomena as a greater whole.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing that Carla Turner told me in like 95 or 96 or whatever.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. She said, I think part of the solution is going to be in the weird stuff that nobody wants to pay attention to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's not sexy, you know?
No, it's not. And then it also hooks in with the thing that Bruce Duensing said on my show, that people don't like, complexity. They don't like getting into details of stuff. And
yeah,
you know, if you're talking about something weird like this, like this book you wrote and a lot of the elements of this subject and the ones related to it, you have to be detail-oriented and you have to think in a complicated manner at least part of the time. Because otherwise, yeah, you just keep rolling the same simple, spoon-fed, this is what everybody thinks, how can I riff on it, ideas through your head, and it does nothing. And yeah, the exasperation is like, I finally got to the point, just like when we did the magazine, it's like, we don't like any of this stuff. Well, why don't you just not care about it and go off and do what you do like? And so, yeah, hence, you're on the show. So silly. Here, let me switch back. I got Joshua back again. Okay, can you hear me there?
Yeah. So is she singing the actual lyrics, the "Somewhere Beyond the Stars" in the recording? Or?
I think she is actually singing those lyrics. Yeah, I found some place online that had a bunch of songs that you didn't think have lyrics to them, which had lyrics, like "Baby Elephant Walk," sung by Pat Boone.
Are you serious? I'm going to have to bug you about this because that is amazing.
Maybe you can play that on the tuba.
Oh man, I remember the first time that I heard the lyrics to Teddy Bear's Picnic, which I didn't even really – I don't think I would realize that it had words.
That is
either.
A frightening song.
Yeah, it's horrifying. Yeah. It's horrifying. Again, it's Teddy Ruxpin coming into your bedroom at night, right?
Yeah.
I can't even remember what we were talking about now.
I can't either. Wait.
Something about ambiguity and not knowing things. And I think I remember the quote that I was going to use, but I don't know what – How it fit into the conversation at large.
I don't either. But we'd started with, you know, why did you write the book? What made you interested in it? And you went into, well, this stuff isn't usually covered and it's not considered that important. And then we went to the, well, people don't like complexity. At least that's what I said.
Oh, yeah. So you have to be comfortable sitting with these sort of mysteries is what McKenna had said. And then, you know, where is it written anywhere that anthropoid apes are supposed to unravel the mysteries of the universe? You know? Yeah.
Yeah, I got the thing about, you know, we're trying to communicate these very subtle ideas with grunts and beating rocks and things like that. Basically, the equivalent of trying to describe these very strange, weird things. Which actually brings us to a theme of the book, which is probably should be asked later: is what's going on in people's minds when this goes on or whatever. But I think we should go to that later because we'll jump over like 15 questions I have here. We'll get to it though because that'll be in there. And some of, you know, I wrote these questions down as I went through the book, which I read, you know, like half of about a month ago, and then I read the other half in the last 3 days.
You read half of it a month ago, and then I bugged you.
Yeah, well, I had to go back to the place where I left the book and get it, not realizing I could have just bought it on Amazon and just stuck it on my Kindle and read it.
No worries. No worries at all. I'm just glad that I'm here.
One of the first things you talk about is abduction accounts. And you said they involve – a lot of them involve food-like exchanges or offerings. And then, you know, a lot of people would beg to differ with that. But I agree with you. What do you mean by that? I mean, you never say – you know, they don't say to the abductee, here, have some Kentucky Fried Chicken. It's not something like that. But it's a lot more subtle, at least symbolically, right?
Well, and that's part of the reason why, you know, I didn't – I really want to be scientific about this in like the social science sense of providing statistics and such, but everything becomes so ambiguous after a certain point. You know, I would call food and abduction experiences a minor motif, by which I mean it's not one of these common things that, you know, my car stops working. You know, I was taken to a room with a white light and, you know, there was all this medical pageantry as it was. But it's definitely something that, like, is not uncommon. And especially when you start realizing if there is food given, if there's a substance administered, then what substances does that encompass? I mean, and I think that you can argue very easily that injections, and especially pills, but injections are a variation on this trope, because you look at the phenomena always staying, you know, 10 steps ahead of what we're doing or changing itself to fit with the times. And that's exactly – it's exactly what it is, you know? I mean, you look at the era before medical examinations and abduction lore, and you'll find people being given food. But as soon as the medical examination motif comes in there, people are getting syringes of stuff. People are getting covered in ointments and such. So, I think that it's hard to turn a blind eye to that in terms of what that means. I mean, to me, it's almost like saying there are no more flying saucers because there are flying saucers. They just don't look like flying saucers anymore. If that makes sense.
Yes, makes total sense.
So. I do kind of bristle a little bit when people, you know, don't think that this is something that happens, because it's still there. It's just looked at and just presented in a new way. So,
yeah. Well, also begs the question, what do you think the abduction thing is? I don't know. But in the context of your book, what do you think is going on? Because it you know, people are going to think they're, you know, raised on science, raised on the in the way we've been raised in this country, in the West or whatever, to think either something's happening to people or they made it up in their minds and they're just dreaming it or whatever. But I don't think either of those things are going on, and maybe a bit of both. And I think that's kind of your thinking too. But what's your idea about it?
If you really had to nail me down and get me to commit to something, which I am loath to do.
Me too.
I'd have to say that I really do appreciate the idea that we have shut ourselves off to shamanism. Not necessarily meaning pagan worship, but we have shut ourselves off to that spiritual aspect of our lives. And I think that the universe, God, whatever, demands that people are in contact with this in this sense, and demands that people are brought this message. And I think that the abduction narrative is just the shamanic narrative in new clothing. And I think that there is an other intelligence, there's an objective other that is trying to communicate with us, but it's so intertwined in knowing us better than we know ourselves that it uses theater to accomplish its goals, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
still at the same time, I don't like saying that, you know, because something about that doesn't quite ring true. It's still too tidy. It's still too anthropomorphic. It's still too easy for us to understand that concept. You know,
yeah, that's exactly how you've been reading the same people as I.
Yeah.
And what do you think? I keep whining and pushing and wheedling about this idea of how much of is coming from us. And I'm tempted to think in my weirdest moments that way more is coming from us than is coming from whatever it is, because we can only be open to that which makes sense to us.
I think that sort of ties into
– meaning we're garbling the signal.
Yeah. I think that ties into certain Gnostic ideas about, you know, God being within us, you know, it is a part of us because everything is the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
There is no real separation between the inner world and the outer world. And, I think that it's just this goofy Western way of thinking about things where everything has to be one thing or the other thing. And, you know, to bathe yourself in the waters of liminality, I think, is something that's super underrated. you know, in every Western cultural aspect, from religion all the way through to, you know, the way that we try to figure out what it means to be existing in this reality.
It's been garbled for a long time. And it goes back to exactly what you said about getting back to a shamanistic way of looking at things. And then, you know, here we are putting a label on it again. But
right.
At least being open to the part of ourselves that isn't so completely hooked into the right brain.
Right. Right. And, you know, I think that, yeah, okay, any sufficiently advanced technology looks like magic. I get that. Okay, I get it.
Yeah.
I think that at the same time, you are burying your head in the sand if you don't acknowledge the profound weirdness of this stuff. And, you know, and so the nuts and bolts theory, again, another reason why I feel I don't have that weird fear that I used to have is because if it's not nuts and bolts, that doesn't scare me as much. I don't know why, but it doesn't.
It gives you a little tiny, tiny little bit more control.
It does.
Not control, and, but some way of dealing with it whereby you have a choice in how you want to accept it.
Yeah, I never really articulated it that way, but that's a fantastic point. So I think that there is some sort of deep tissue paranormal thing, aspect to the abduction narrative that we're not really glomming onto. You know, at the same time, again, I feel uncomfortable saying that grays are demons or something like that. You know, something so concretized as that, I can't, you know, I can't get behind that either. So
yeah, well, that's a metaphor that's being shoved down the throat of whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it's just this idea that we somehow can understand it. So I've become more interested in the weirdness. Like, if you start talking to me about your field guide to the 250 species of extraterrestrials visiting this planet, my eyes glaze over.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, I have that Homer Simpson thing of the drinking bird in my head, you know?
Which one is that? You got to remind me.
There's one moment where I think somebody in his family was explaining something to him, and it did a cross section of his head, and it was just a drinking bird.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Dipping down and coming back up. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then when you start viewing it through a folkloric lens, you know, people giving these elaborate taxonomies to fairies and to aliens and to Sasquatch, which there are elaborate Sasquatch taxonomies nowadays.
Yes.
You don't hear about it a lot, but people are like, oh, no, the wolfmen are actually baboon-shaped Sasquatch, and they're the shorter ones that are in the south, and they're the taller ones that are in the northwest, and some of them have hooded noses, and some of them don't, and it's, you know, it's like, really?
Yeah. And Batman can beat up Spider-Man, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly what it reminds me of. It's like, well, I guess you found your niche. Otherwise, it would have been comic conventions.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I've got it on a spreadsheet right here. The Zeta Reticulans drive the cigar-shaped ships. Yeah.
And they only come from that galaxy.
Yeah.
God!
So I don't know if, again, I don't know if that really answers your question. I feel like I'm just sitting on a fence.
I've been doing that forever.
And the psychosocial thing, the purely psychosocial thing makes a lot of sense too. I can't say it doesn't, you know?
It's very hard to maintain a soft focus because we're so forced into a sharp focus. And nobody will listen to you if you're in a soft focus, except the kind of people that live in that all the time.
Right.
And those become like new age people that don't make any sense to anybody but themselves. So it's really yeah. hard to find somebody. And I don't know, I guess it has to be a personal system of thought, which, you know, I think this is what you're kind of pointing out in the book in a way, a personal system of thought where you can learn something, but not live there, not live in, you know, one set of ideas, because with something as weird as all this stuff, like in your book, you can't live in a certain set of ideas because only two or three things out of the thousands or maybe hundreds of things, reports you have in your book as examples, only two or three of those things live in that confined set of theories that you've, you know, tried to shove everything into. So
right.
you just can't do that. It's self-limiting, and then you turn into that guy from the Comic-Con.
Yeah, and you know, I literally, when I started writing this book, I literally was losing sleep over, you know, should I include this case? Is this as credible as that? What is my threshold for credibility? But I kind of found out after a while that none of that really matters to me.
Yeah, it was one of my questions. You know? What's the value of the qualitative? Here's an edit over the quantitative.
I think that in some ways, on its face, the value of the qualitative is obvious. I mean, you can,
right.
if you don't know the why of something or you don't know the effect that it has, I mean, I can sit here all day and give you statistics about people's views on the presidential campaign, but unless you have some idea as to their demographics, or unless you have some idea as to the issues that are important to them in their own little slice of this country, none of it really matters, because it just looks like, oh, well, they're going to vote for this person. Well, no, not really. I mean, if some other person were able to capitalize on that and say it in a better way, they'd throw their support behind them. So I think that quantitative has its place. I mean, you know, your cholesterol's too high. Back off. But unless you can figure out why your cholesterol's high, it doesn't matter anything at all. You know,
how does that relate to the subjects in your book? Because there's so many different accounts in there. And what I wanted to say actually at some point in the show, so I'll say it now, is it was like reading an old UFO book to me, except updated and more fun.
Well, thank you.
Because it's like, you know, so-and-so in 1974, so-and-so walked out of his house and there was a buzzing sound and he turned around and then suddenly a bright light flashed and then he was in a room and it's like, wow, all these great stories. And I don't care if I believe them or not. That's not the point. The point is what's being discussed and how it's affecting us and how we view it.
Well, and again, I mean, it's all about, I think to that point in this particular book, it's all about finding the broader strokes of the trends. You know, I think that the trends are nice, but I think being qualitative allows you to keep a foot in. And in some ways, to keep a foot in the objective and the subjective, and allows you to be flexible enough about your thinking that you can bring things into the conversation, like, are ointments a variation on, you know, the food trend?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really in just not forcing you to become too rigid in how you're looking at this. Is that sort of getting at what your question was?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yeah. So I think this was just like, it's the same. it's in some ways the reason why both atheists and fundamentalists are equally obnoxious, because there's nothing more of a turnoff than I have all the answers. You know, people want to have some sort of degree of flexibility and some degree of mystery about things. And I think that if you can approach, some people do. Well, the people that I want to talk to do.
Yes.
So I think that the rigidity of thinking is the death of further learning. I'm not sure where I'm sort of spiraling out of control here.
That's okay. That's what I do. I do that through the entire show, but I'm able to cover for it.
Well, now I've wound up with this melange of ideas. So,
I'm thinking too fast. Go ahead.
But the sort of thing that allowed me to really give myself a break, as it were, about what is credible and what isn't credible, is that a lot of the trends I started noticing kind of became predictive. I was watching, there's one story in there about a girl who was playing in a boulder field in Iceland, and she falls beside a boulder and a fairy comes out. And as I'm listening to this, she says, you know, on this documentary, she says, they gave me, and I'm like, okay. So, and immediately I said, okay, fairy. So, like, fruit juice and bread. And she said, oh, yeah, spiral shaped cake and some funny banana juice. And I'm like, well, that's, you know. So when it starts to become, I don't even know how you make banana juice, but
ask Dr. Seuss.
Yeah. but when you can start to see trends like that, and you can sort of roll with the punches of that. Then that's when I think that you really are onto something. So, not saying that I have, you know, not saying that my groundbreaking book has determined this particular trend, and it's always going to, you know, always going to play out that way. But I think that I don't think necessarily you can come to that by making a spreadsheet and saying, you know, in 15% of the cases this happens, and in 25% of the cases this happens. You know, I don't think that's a productive way to really sort of be able to adapt to things in different stories.
Well, you kind of tried to do that in the book, but not in a quantitative way. You just see things. The thing I remember is, like, most of the exchanges or offerings of something that's to be ingested are liquid.
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me of what Mike Cleland is really good about doing, is saying, it seems to me that,
yeah,
or it's my sense that, which I really admire him for doing. So, yeah, I mean, that was, for me doing that, it was me trying to just show that I put in, you know, I'd made a good faith effort in trying to approach it that way and being like, look, this is what you're given. This is what that approach yields, but there's so much room for ambiguity and interpretation of things that it's not really that useful. And trying to, it was sort of a roundabout way of me trying to illustrate that.
Yeah, because and then you go into a thing later. It's like, well, you know, symbolically, what is this liquid? Why is it always liquid? Why is it mostly liquid?
Yeah, I mean, and it's very stark in terms of the predominance of liquid. If you really had to pin me down on a percentage, it's like at least 60% of cases with fairies and aliens and whatnot are liquid. you know, some people have read this and been like, well, why is Sasquatch in here? And of course, Sasquatch is in there because of that food taboo that we talked about earlier. But what I found really interesting to me is as much sympathy as I give non-biological Bigfoot ideas these days, the data that I came to, and I really tried to let the data push me in a direction as opposed to trying to approach it from my own personal views.
Yeah.
The data seems to say that there's something that's much more different there going on than with fairies and aliens.
In what way? Ways.
Well, I mean, Sasquatch hardly ever give liquids. And I think that this liquid idea is – I think it's important to understanding UFO fairy lore in general. You know, that the idea of being fluid, the idea of – you know, the idea manifests itself in popular culture all the time. You had that the trope from the X-Files of the liquid – the oilian, the liquid, liquid alien.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's something there that doesn't there is a metaphor there that does not graft onto the Bigfoot phenomena as well. And at the same time, the foods associated with Bigfoot don't support that metaphor either.
Right.
They really do in terms of that this data set, it seems to suggest more of a biological
origin.
Entity. Yeah, origin, yeah. So
okay, well, you know what? Let me ask the regular radio show question, because to have a bebop session, you need a little bit of structure.
Yeah.
So let's stick some rhythm in there. What kind of things are given to people, and how did you throw them into these categories? And we'll go off from there too, because there's so many. You know, everything you could think of to eat practically, well, except for octopus and stuff like that, is mentioned in the book. In large, fairly well defined categories.
Yeah, I mean, the most difficult thing is that there are so many of these stories where the memories are vague. I was given something to eat. I was given something to drink. So that's the first real way that you can sort of approach this. And you put those into their respective camps, and then you just, I mean, like literally just going through cases and trying to see. You know, trying to think of them in terms of the next broader category. So liquid is pretty much black and white. Either it's terrestrial and recognizable or it's not. Foods, I generally just said, okay, let's think about it in terms of like the food pyramid. You know, meat within meat, what kinds of meats? Grain within grain, what can grain mean? You know, vegetables and fruits and thinking of it that way. And similarly, just sitting back and letting some trends emerge on their own, like this weird tendency for fruit juices to appear, was really striking to me. And I'm not entirely sure what that means. I do go into in the book, you know, this idea of the sattvic diet, this idea of, I mean, I'm kind of pleased that I went in that direction, because I'm not someone who really has a ton of Eastern religious philosophy in my wheelhouse, but I noticed this lacto-vegetarian trend that can be broadly applied, especially to the fairy and alien stuff, and for there to be that and this strange correlation and this strange precedent, as it were, and not only that, but for the frequency to also line up with the emphasis of importance in those fields. So, in other words, lacto-vegetarian diets are not a new thing, but the level of emphasis in the sattvic diet of Hindu culture lines up like almost a one-to-one comparison with a lot of these trends that I noticed. You know, the emphasis on fruit juice as being one of the best sattvic foods, and the prevalence of fruit juice in these cases is something that really just was something of a revelation for me. And for those, I feel like I'm getting a little bit insider baseball-y. So for anybody who hasn't read the book,
yes, please. I was about to say, yes. So what are the broad categories here, and how did you say, hey, wait a second, this is really like dropping into these reported categories quite nicely?
Yeah. So the main categories are, as I said, about a majority are liquid. Within liquids, you will see fruit juices and bitter liquids. And not surprisingly, a lot of those line up along the lines of the abductee and contactee experience. So the my thumbnail sketch for people who aren't familiar with those terms are abductee equals involuntary, unpleasant, consuming under duress, and taste profiles that are unpleasant. Either that means bitter, it means, or on the other end of the spectrum, cloyingly sweet, super sweet to the point of making you sick. Then the contactee experience, I usually deem as voluntary, positive, and the flavor profiles reflect that as well. Consuming voluntarily, consuming flavorful foods, which again, taking a psychosocial approach, just means that, well, you know, of course, it's you're projecting this negative experience onto whatever you're doing. Of course, you have this, you know, these bad tastes, or this positive experience. Of course, you have these positive tastes. So those are the big categories within the liquids. I drew the line at really going into a survey and analysis of injections because it's just. First project, trying to wrap my arms around this and trying to find a way to tackle it was difficult enough as it stands here. Within foods, one of the most predominant things that you'll find are grains. But again, we wrestle with this issue of ambiguity. Is one generation's grain product, like a wafer or a cracker, described by a previous generation as or a future generation as being a pill, you know? Yeah. Is there some sort of, yeah. I mean, like, if I went back and gave an ibuprofen, or, like, no, that's probably not a good example. If I gave Oxycontin to Shakespeare, what would he say it was, you know? They might say it was some sort of wafer or cracker or something along those lines. So So there's, again, this part of the issue that part of the reason that it isn't as quantitative as I wanted, as, you know, I might be appreciated is because, you know, it's sort of difficult. You run into some issues of ambiguity there. So grains are incredibly prevalent. Fruits and vegetables are incredibly prevalent. Almost completely absent from the literature is meats or candies, which I think, especially in Western reports, is really fascinating and to me argues against it being a purely psychological phenomenon because, I mean – Hey, look, I'm as guilty as anybody. I love me some meat and I love me some candy. But like you think that if you're going to fabricate or your subconscious is going to fabricate something that you would incorporate that as opposed to they gave me a loaf of bread or they gave me, you know, fruit that tasted like a papaya. It's like, no, that doesn't make any sense. You'd think that there would be this emphasis on protein and emphasis on sweets. So within that, you also have to address some certain other trends, looking at these connections between different phenomena and the history of salt as a prophylactic against evil and as a way of safeguarding oneself against the fairies. You have to say, well, does salt factor into this at all? You could write an entire book probably on the role of salt in a lot of these cases and just the role of salt in the paranormal, as it were. Red Pill Junkie did a great job on an old Mysterious Universe article. That I think he could spin out into a book if you're listening.
I think he's listening.
Oh, he's listening. I'm just saying that because I know he's listening. I keep on pushing him to write.
Me too.
And I'm going to publicly shame him until he does.
I got to start doing that.
Interestingly enough, even fewer than meat and candy. Salt just doesn't really appear in a lot of these cases.
Salty taste.
Salty foods. Sorry, yeah. Salt. So foods being described as being salty. And some of the ones that I found that were salty seem to have gained traction as being more of fabrications as opposed to actual encounters. And again, like what you read in the book is like a fraction of what I collected because some of them aren't that interesting, you know.
That's the quantitative part.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like – Reading a paragraph about somebody, you know, being given fruit juice in a Brad Steiger book from 1985 doesn't really translate into being that relevant to what we're talking about because, okay, well, yeah, it's fruit juice. Put that in the fruit juice category, but it doesn't describe you anything about the flavor profile, any comparisons to any earthly food, you know, Yeah. So just those are the broad strokes, and then in liquids you also find, I completely forgot about this. Liquids you also find things described as being milk-like, being white and thick. Which I think is in a lot of ways comparable to milk. So that's where the lacto issue comes in. You don't see a lot of cheeses. You'll see some gelatins. Pills are also discussed in the book. But again, that's sort of entering that gray area of where do you draw the line between a food and something that's given for some sort of effect. Of all the common things, the common foods, pills are the least common of the common, if that makes any sense. So you look at all this and you try to see if there's anything in our world and our understanding that really maps on. And there's some loose correlations between the classical ideas of body humors being supported, phlegms and dry phlegm and wet phlegm. There's a little bit of a correlation there, not strong enough that I really felt comfortable going into. But there's a strong correlation for these foods to line up with the foods recommended in the sattvic diet. And the sattvic diet, to make it really short, is the notion in Hindu philosophy that eating certain foods can promote well-being, spiritual well-being. Rajasic, tamasic, and sattvic foods. So those are the three categories. Basically, bad foods, foods that incite passions, and spiritual foods. And the interesting thing is, the sattvic diet is the diet preferred by seers and mystics and clairvoyants, and those who are spiritually enlightened. So again, there's another connection here between the supernatural spiritual realm and the UFO phenomena, the fairy phenomena, which I thought was too tempting to ignore. So that definitely comes up in the story. Some of the things that people report after their experiences, like coming back and changing their diets, a lot of times their diets will reflect the sattvic diet. They'll reflect a more healthy, earth-conscious means of eating, which I think is not inconsequential either.
Yeah. You probably already made this clear, but most of the things you found that people were being offered by whatever entities they are, fairies, aliens, whatever you want to call them, not Sasquatch though, would adhere to the mystic, seer, spiritual diet more than the other ones.
Cause right.
Did you just kind of happen on that, or?
I was reading, I was thumbing through the old Funk and Wagnall's Dictionary of Folklore, and I kind of happened on it. I happened sort of approached it from a different angle. I was brought into it through the idea of hot foods and cold foods. Not hot in terms of like serving temperature, but in terms of foods that
spicy.
Well, no, not even in terms of spice. In terms of foods that incite or quench passions.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And so in looking into that, I stumbled on the sattvic trend. Which, is another thing whenever you do a project like this is you wonder what there might be an even stronger correlation somewhere out there that hasn't even, come to mind, or it's just not, it really was fortuitous that I sort of went in that direction. But, again, with something that's sense-related, my next book is going to be sense-related as well. People have written entire books on the physiology and the folklore of taste, on the symbolism of taste. So like you're trying to figure out where you draw that line and what connections, what things feel like connections, but you can't really make connections with. Like, this feels like it's important, but I can't really draw a one-to-one, a one-to-one connection there, Like, it feels like it's important that nobody's given beef and beef is destroying the planet. That feels important, but I can't really come out and, it's not really a good way to articulate that.
Yeah, but you'll find one. I have a super listener, Steve Ray, question for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Steve writes, people have nightmares after eating spicy foods as if their brains are building a context for why their bodies are feeling pain. Could the perception, and I guess that's just a comment, but and his question is, could the perception of sharing a meal be a context for a person feeling an emotional bond? Because I don't think people in the book ever really share a meal with these with the aliens and fairies, they're offered them.
Yeah, it's pretty rare, which I think
it's kind of a one-way street, except in a later chapter you do talk about an exchange, but of goods and services, not really of food.
Yeah, not really. Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that I didn't really talk about this, but I think it's sort of self-evident. You know, Whitley Strieber's communion.
there's a good word for tonight.
Yeah, I think that it's not. I'm going to say not inconsequential again. I need to stop using that phrase. Something different, Josh.
Go ahead.
I think it's important, the idea that, you know, there's not really a breaking of bread between the other and us. It seems like, you know, this is intended for you. It's not intended for us. And I think that reinforces, A, the idea that it's not – in some ways it reinforces the idea that it's not physical food because, hey, this is something just for you. But also I think that more than that, it reinforces the idea that this is given to produce an effect. It's not sustenance. I think that there's a real link there too about between that and the idea of gift giving as being a deceptive act. In some circles of psychological study as well. But back to Steve's point about like the body reacting and the body using certain stimuli after eating or consuming and grafting a narrative onto that.
Yeah.
I think that speaks to sort of your ideas of co-creation as well. You know, I think that trying to separate the inner and outer world is a lot stickier of a conundrum than I think a lot of people want to acknowledge.
Yeah. I mean, it's especially with weirdness like this, it's just, you've heard me talk about this before, and maybe you can riff on this. It's just like the thing that's hitting your senses and your brain and the way your brain processes information when this weird thing is going on is not really well understood. And I think that is very important. It's a lot more important than, you know, which planet did they come from? It's a lot more important than that. It's like one of those things where, you know, something's sitting there staring you in the face, yourself, but you ignore it because it's part of you. You're ignoring the instrument.
right. I mean, in some ways it's almost like, I don't really know how relevant that is, but I feel like it's the idea of pointing at something for a dog to go fetch and they stare at your finger. You know,
right?
But and now I completely lost my train of thought. What was the comment again?
The comment was, you mentioned the co-creation thing that I've been whining and wheedling about for a couple years now. But the thing is that we forget that the instrument that's is recording this is, you know, what is the measuring system for the instrument? What does the instrument measure? How good is it at recording information? And what does it do to the information when it plays it back to you?
Well, yeah, and it's in you know, are our sensors calibrated properly to interpret the true nature of the outside world, the external world? You know, which I think again, it seems like a cheap point to bring up, but that dadgum Twitter dress fiasco.
Yeah.
If you recall that.
Yes.
You know, I will return to that well many times throughout the coming years because it's the most clearly demonstrable object lesson of the concepts that I think, again, the people that I want to talk to are talking about in this field. You know,
I never really thought about that as a metaphor for it, but it's perfect.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's this idea that you can objectively know certain things, I think it's kind of passé, at least in my worldview. You know, everything is subjective. You know, that's not an idea original to me. Like a lot of people have said that, you know, you're still filtering and you're still interpreting everything about your world. But you know, it's sort of the idea. There's, I can't remember what it was. I think it was either an actual conversation or it was a conversation from a Michael Crichton book, which I know are two completely very different things.
Well, here we are with perception, memory, and all that. Go ahead.
But it was like a meeting of some NASA astronauts, and the first question is, well, where's the anus? You know, they're looking at they're theorizing. I'm sorry, that was not did not set that up well.
I know what you're getting to. I mean, I flashed at exactly what you were going to talk about when you said it, but go ahead.
Nice. Yeah, they were speculating on what extraterrestrial life would look like, and one of the questions from one of the less scientifically inclined people was, well, where's the anus? And it's this idea that like.
There's a T-shirt.
Where's the just have a strike through the word beef?
Yeah,
and where's anus? It's what's for anyway. that's Angus. That's Angus. Sorry.
Yes. Black Angus.
But this idea that the things that we use to navigate our world and the things that we use to exist and to sustain ourselves in this particular planet, this particular reality, the idea that those are what every foreign life form, if you want to be literal about it, would use is so ridiculous. You know, I mean, it's just as likely. Not only is it just as likely that we would have evolved, if appropriate, sensors to, you know, detect radiation or something, senses to detect radiation. But it's entirely likely that concepts we're just now familiar with, concepts like say that they eventually are able to definitively prove dark matter. Maybe we didn't even think about that as a concept, but maybe on some alien world there is a sense to negotiate and to locate and to see and perceive dark matter is just as important to that particular organism as us seeing is, you know?
Yeah. And as you were going through this, I thought from now on, I want to try and start a trend. Every time somebody's showing too much interpretation in one way or another, like, well, that's so-and-so from Zeta Reticuli, you immediately yell Twitter dress.
Yeah.
Twitter dress. Exactly. Stop it. Twitter dress.
Exactly. Yeah. And in a lot of ways, it's kind of like a great object lesson that a lot of classical musicians will give you to really encourage you to emote is they will use the example of, well, think about the way a sentence can go and the emphasis that you put on certain words. Where are you going? Where are you going? Where are you going? Where are you going? Where are you going?
Yeah.
Like five completely different meanings, but reduced to their simplest form are all the same thing, but they're not. They're not at all the same thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, this idea that we can have discrepancies in our conversations or in the written word, too. That's part of the reason that, you know, writing is sometimes a problem for some people is that they can't get across those other subtleties. And I think that, you know, if we can't even agree on meanings of written words, how can we possibly hope to understand something that is as alien in the sense of the other, as a lot of these things that we're talking about?
Yeah. Here's one of my questions, and it'll throw us off on a different thing for just a very slight amount. You have one account in there of a woman from New York City in an apartment in 1955 that had some kind of entity visitation and a food thing. I can't remember what the exact story was. But you said the woman's name was Barbara Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
That is the name of a woman who was Jim Moseley's girlfriend for a while in the 1960s.
I am inclined,
I think she was a black woman, too.
Was she a researcher and an aficionado in her own right?
I think so, yeah.
I think it's the same lady.
What happened to her? Do you remember what that story is?
Yeah, give me a second. This is actually the first interview I think I've ever done where I don't have a PDF of the book in front of me so that I can sound really smart. So give me a quick second here. She woke up and she was surprised. There was this entity that was in her room, and she was quite surprised to discover that it actually ended up. There was a miss in her apartment, I believe.
Oh, I found it.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, researcher Barbara Hudson described a case from the summer of 1955 when she awoke to find a tall being with glowing eyes in her New York City bedroom. Wow, sounds like Pam Stonebrook. The entity asked the witness to follow him, taking her to the living room where a gray mist had collected. They were immediately transported to a metallic elevator-like enclosure and exited into a corridor that terminated in a room bathed in bright pink light. Inside were approximately nine other beings, all tall with black hair, examining various monitors. She was eventually led to yet another area where she was given a meal consisting of wines and fruits resembling, quote, an apple or something that looked like a melon, unquote. After finishing her meal, she was informed it was time to return home. She was taken back to her apartment via the gray mist.
Yeah, like what you said. Yeah, that.
Yeah.
yeah, so there's some interesting, I mean, like, you know, there's some interesting motifs there in terms of an ascent and consumption and return that I found in a 1931 Indian case that I'm not really even entirely sure is valid, but I thought there were some interesting similarities there. But yeah, from what I can tell, I think it's probably the same Barbara Hudson. But again, this idea that, I mean, I don't care what sort of technology, what sort of technology you have to make up to say, oh, well, I can find the idea of aliens possessing technology to phase you through your window a lot easier to swallow than technology that puts an elevator in your room. you know what I mean? So it sounds like,
yes, this sounds like dream logic.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, a lot of this sounds like dream logic.
Oh yeah, exactly. And you know,
sticking a category in it by saying dreams, but you know what I mean?
Well, that's a nice little segue because I found some, you know, I didn't really go into this in too much depth, but super important. The consumption of food and dreams. The Ogun Oru of Yoruba mythology, Yoruba, the West African culture, saying that if you eat food in a dream, you'll be afflicted with sleep paralysis, and that's some sort of spirit entity that wants to make you its sexual slave, because the way that they do that is they gain access to your consciousness by giving you food in a dream. I think that's a really important connection. I'm gesturing very wildly right now, if you can only see it.
I do too during shows.
There's some examples, anecdotal. Yeah. Okay. Well, a lot of things are anecdotal. Our understanding of psychology in a lot of senses is anecdotal, but there have been anecdotal examples where people have consumed, drugs in dreams.
Yeah.
They've supposedly gotten high from smoking a joint in a dream. So the idea, you know, is this mind over matter idea. And if that sort of food simulacra, as it were, can be the logic of that can be used to somehow gain access to consciousness or actually create some sort of change in the mind, in the brain, rather, I think is sort of crucial to that. And, you know, trying to get that across in a way that sounds grounded, in a way that doesn't sound like it's you're jumping to conclusions, was one of the more difficult aspects of writing. But hopefully I was able to walk people through that logic in a clear and lucid manner.
Well, I thought that was one of the other comments I had about the book. Did I say this already? It sounds academic without trying to be so academic that it's academic. Meaning,
yeah,
and then I see you have two master's degrees. It's like, well, you've been kind of tracked into making sure that people know where you got your ideas from. You got your references straight and giving examples and, you know, all that, which is rare in the paranormal writing arena.
Yeah, one of my mentors, David Zirkle at the University of Georgia, he always used to joke that when he was in the military bands, he used to play sousaphone for a lot of, you know, for a lot of ceremonial stuff. And he used to say, I'm a professional sousaphone player. That's like being the world's tallest midget. or as I like to say sometimes, being a big guy myself, the skinniest kid at fat camp. and sometimes, like, you know, I really wrestled with, like, are these sources good enough to put in? How reliable is this or how reliable is that? But again, like, I did the legwork, and this just by merit of the fact that you're doing the legwork is going to put you head and shoulders above a lot of people in this area. And I feel like, you know, if I wanted to have conversations with the people that I respect, I needed to do that. So there were some, man, I tell you what, there were some abso-freaking-lutely great cases that I just wasn't able to use because I didn't think that, you know, the provenance of the source, not even the provenance of the believability, but just like literally like where it was written down didn't seem that reliable, you know. And the internet's made all that a lot harder. But
oh, okay. Now, you know, go ahead.
at the end of the day, like, even there's some stuff from the internet in here, but I'm saying, look, this is where I found it. So, and again, something else I wrestled with, like, how do I know whether or not I should include this? Well, the trends bear themselves out. So I wouldn't doubt it if, you know, 50% of these things are garbage. But even removing that, that some of the trends are so strong, like the liquid trend is so strong that I don't think it would really change the overarching pattern.
Yeah. You said some of these are so ridiculous that you just get, and they were wonderful. Like what? I want some Trojan Feast porno.
Okay. You want to play that game? We can do that.
Yeah, for one or two. Yeah.
There was a guy in Ireland, who said that he was taken aboard a craft and he, I think it was like more of a contactee sort of scenario. So more of a human like entity. And he was given a hamburger.
When was this?
Oh man, I honestly didn't include it in the book, so I don't have it on me.
20th century, probably.
Yeah, 20th century, and you know, I found it, and I was like, it's interesting, but it was interesting because it was, you know, a good outlier because you don't run into meat. But I'm like, I can't even say that. There was another one that was these kids. There was this weird, strange narrative of these kids being taken to this foundry on and. Another world, and one of them, their stomach got upset, and they gave them a cone that was filled with some oil, like an ice cream cone filled with oil, and they ate it, and it made their stomach feel better or something, which I do allude to in the book, but I don't source it because I'm like, there are certain stories that have said things like, you know?
Yeah, I remember the cone thing.
Yeah, so that was another one that was kind of like, well, this is really interesting, but I, you know, so it's, again, trying to walk that line between saying there are these stories out there and they're really interesting, but I don't really feel like they should make the cut. And you know, some of them I really still wasn't convinced. I mean, you know, there are some stories from Pravda in the book, and I don't think that's that's always the most reliable source. But some of them were too good.
The name means truth.
Of course.
Yeah, but see, they weren't. See, I don't think that those weird stories were put in there to prop up Soviet propaganda or philosophy or communism. They're just weird stories.
Well, and again, the weirder a story is, the more likely I am to believe it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, me too.
Like the one that you always return to from Albert Rosales' database of the terry cloth covered banana people.
Yeah, well, I read that in UFOs Over the Americas by Coral and Jim Lorenzen.
Okay.
I'm sure Albert put it in his database, yeah. And you used – I noticed you referenced him a couple times in the book saying, yeah, he's got a bunch of great things on there.
It's great. It's a great place to start with looking at some of this stuff because even if – because I'll be honest, there's some stuff – and this is not Albert's fault. There's some stuff in there that I'm pretty sure is straight up bunk.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, anything like this where you start collecting these things, there's going to be a certain proportion of them that are.
Yeah.
But those are the ones that aren't very creative. In fact, you probably have the same idea as me. Exactly. The more sense it makes, the less true it probably is.
Yeah, exactly. He's done so much legwork, and that it's a great place to start for a project like this, you know, because you can literally come up with some do your best job at finding some generating some really thorough search terms and do a, you know, a search and find and look for stuff that way, you know.
Yeah, I mean, all you have to have is some keywords and vast worlds of strangeness open up.
Yeah, exactly. Now, of course, the difficult part of that is making sure that you thesaurusificate those words enough to make sure that you cover all your ground. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, my next project I've just started writing it. It's going to be about smells. Because you know, a lot of people have said, "Oh, well, sometimes occasionally UFOs smell of sulfur, and sometimes Bigfoot smells like rotten eggs." So we're that you know, it's obviously tied into folklore about the devil. Moving on, but nobody's ever really said, "Well, does that mean anything?"
No,
you know, there have been a paper here and there or whatever. But anyway, so for this one, for this project, going through some of those reports and you know, trying to say, okay, so smell, whiff, odor, scent. You know, trying to come up with all the terms to really make sure that you get a good cross section of what's said.
Oh, I'll give you a piece for that. Remember, I think the alien astronaut Story Musgrave. I believe it was him. He said that outer space smelled a little like mold.
A lot of
how can it have a smell? It's a vacuum.
Modern astronaut reports are that when they bring their gear back, sometimes it will smell like either some sort of combustion-y sort of smell or moon dust smells like gunpowder, which again, this weird sulfur connection. It's going to be structured a lot differently because this book really is like an inverted pyramid in journalism. Like you start out wide and it gets narrower and narrower and it just really sort of guides you down this one path. But this book is going to be like fractal branching leaf or something, you know, in terms of like, well, here's this. And if this means this and this means this and this Perfect. Means this, I'm going to take you down like 30 different paths that are three layers deep, but I don't really think there's an overarching theory of anything. And then, you know, at the end, I'm going to bring up alchemy, which is a whole cluster in and of itself. Like one of the most opaque things that I've ever looked into deliberately. So,
yes, it is. And I think it's very important to look into an alchemy occult angle. And that, you know, people in the UFO biz have been saying this since the beginning of the UFO biz. There's a lot of information in those traditions that should be looked at. I'm glad you brought it up, but the fact that alchemy and some occult traditions, Western occult traditions, I think they are an attempt to balance the left and right brain.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's entirely a big chunk of it. You know, this is another reason that you should read Patrick Harper's Demonic Realities, because he really goes into the idea of the hermetic versus the Apollonic. And how we are giving way too much, hermetic meaning more of the
secret stuff,
lunar, loosey goosey, fluid.
Oh, okay.
World,
okay.
the world of esoterica versus the Apollonic, meaning the knowledge, information, conquering, masculine, sun dominated. You know.
Yeah.
And how we have sort of completely abandoned the hermetic in favor of the Apollonic in today's society.
Oh God! And, now I really have to read it.
The response of reality is to try to strive and inject some of that hermeticism back into the world. Seriously, honestly, I can't put this book over enough. It really did change a lot of my thinking, or even more than that, really did solidify, or like I said, try to say some things that I've been thinking and dancing around for a long time, which is why I read it. And I'm like, well, geez, what am I supposed to write about now? Holy cow.
And yeah, then, maybe that's why I'm scared to read books like that. It's like, oh, I was thinking about them. Like, oh, he wrote it 20 years ago. Oh, wow.
Yeah. But, you know, the funny thing is I actually reached out to him afterwards because I think I'm going to be on a round table with him on Where Did the Road Go?
Yeah.
Which I'm a big fan of Where Did the Road Go. Anybody listening to this, I think, would get a lot out of it because and you should talk to Soraya sometime, too. I think y'all would really, really hit it off well.
I know. I think the second or third person to say that.
Yeah, and I've told him to reach out to you, so we'll see what happens. I volunteered you for that.
Okay.
I reached out to him because I not only wanted to introduce myself, but I also wanted to see what his take was on sort of this smell issue that I'm looking into. And he's like, oh, I never really thought of that. And I'm like, yes,
exactly.
That's awesome. Awesome. Don't say anything else. That's great. That's great. It's like, it's a great idea. I've never thought of it. I'm like, okay, I'm on the right track. Here we go. So, yeah.
We haven't talked about yet, and depending on how long you want to stay on or how annoyed your neighbors will get by you playing the tuba this late.
I plan on playing the tuba for like 2 or 3 minutes, so okay. I don't think that they're going to be too bugged by it.
Okay. I'm expecting a virtuoso performance.
We'll see. Now, I've never done anything musical on this USB mic that I have, so we're going to have to do a quick sound check.
Okay, we'll do that. An entire section of the book we haven't got to yet was entheogens and shamanism.
Yeah.
Well, we did touch a little bit on shamanism.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I mean, the thing that where I came down on this is, number one, people have psychedelic and entheogen-related experiences where entities give them food. There's that great example where Graham Hancock actually remembered the food taboo and was like, nope, no thanks. But also, like, all of the creation myths for these entheogens are generally handed down from gods. So in that sense, it's, you know, it's entity food, as it were, that we can actually study, you know, that we actually have access to. And again, I don't think if you, if you're honest with yourself and you look at these trends and you look at the similarities, if you aren't saying that there is a connection between this, between aliens, fairies, and to a certain degree, Sasquatch, and the psychedelic experience, you are not, you're not being honest.
Right.
You know? So that was just sort of a natural place to, a natural direction to go in for me. And, one that really did sort of, I mean, it's kind of funny to read people's thoughts on something that you've written.
Right. Like
and,
what?
Well, and to see how they interpreted what you said in a different way than you meant for it to.
Oh yes. That happens quite a bit.
I've had some,
no matter how clear you try to be.
I've had some people I really admire say, Cutchin posits that entity food are entheogens. And I'm like, I kind of feel like I go out of my way at one point to specifically say that you can't make that conclusion, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that in a symbolic fashion, they provide a similar purpose. And at the same time, this is a minor motif of these accounts. It doesn't happen in every account. So you can't say, you know, that these things, well, A, you can't say that these things are providing this food to generate the encounter, and B, they've already appeared when they give you this food, so they can't be doing it to generate the encounter either.
Yeah, and in fact, you point out actually more than once that some of them are given to take people out of the encounter.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting, and which is, you know, runs very contrary to, runs very contrary to what, you know, the food taboo explicitly states. So I think that you have to be, again, not so rigid in the way that you interpret that and saying, you know, well, maybe, I mean, these people are, even people who have a fleeting experience with something that might have been a ghost, carry that with them for the rest of their lives. And I think to some reason that might be what the you're stuck in fairyland forever really is. It means that you can't go home. You know, you can't go back to where you were, to what you once knew, to who you once were.
You're changed forever. Yeah.
Yeah. Your worldview has been shattered.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think but I think, you know, so, again, we're in these loosey goosey, you know, you try to put some sort of theory or idea on this, and it eventually always falls apart because there's always some sort of hole in it. And, you know, there's sort of a hole in this idea too, but I think that the symbolism, because,
well, we're trying to make these things complex enough that we can address a lot of the things into not maybe a, you know, like a meta theory, but meeting it on its own terms, which is not categorizable. So you're going to have to use your qualitative thinking and your nonlinear thinking to deal with something that's nonlinear as hell.
Yeah. Yeah, and I again, looking at the cause of these things as opposed to what they objectively are, I think is important. And I think that, well, you know, it's like I heard McKenna talking about, and I think this was actually an idea that McKenna co-opted from Valet. He was talking about the notion that, you know, certain things happen in history to break people out of ways of thinking. And I think the example that Valet had provided, and if it's not Valet, my sincerest apologies, but was the idea that Christ appeared at a time when Roman strength was high, and the adoption of Christianity really subverted the entire Roman way of thinking. You know, obviously to the point that, you know, became a Christian empire eventually.
Right.
So I think that we are more entrenched in this idea, this rigid thinking, this rigid, non-flexible, super linear thinking, that I think that the service, the function that a lot of these things might serve nowadays, which I think in some senses has gotten more spiritual and strange and loosey-goosey and non-materialistic since the 80s, is partially trying just to break us out of that spiraling pattern.
Yeah. Yeah, probably the addition or the rise of the, you know, psychological or loosey-goosey, as you call it, I think that's a – when people start saying, well, this is psychological mumbo-jumbo, it's like, well, Jesus, the entire field is psychological mumbo-jumbo.
Well,
you
can't again,
really do anything about it. You have to deal with it the way it comes in and figure out what that is rather than exposing it, some sort of external reality on it. At least, that's not gotten us anywhere, really.
Well, and again, Greg, back to this idea of being able to know anything, everything is psychological.
Yeah, you
know
exactly.
What I mean?
It's all psychological. Yeah. Everything is. Not just UFO stuff, not just Bigfoot, Sasquatch, aliens, fairies, elves, and gnomes, and whatever else, brownies. Yeah. It's all coming through that instrument.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that where do we even start this line of thought?
I can't remember.
Okay.
Oh, I was what was I going to say? Oh, we started with entheogens, and you said that people like didn't understand what you were saying about it.
Right.
And one thing that came up in my mind actually before we go on was that it seems like I'm sorry if I'm talking too much. But
it seems like
the entheogens are self-administered to get you to that place in a lot of cases where you would have to just come through by happenstance in any other way.
Well, you know, it's interesting because in alchemy they talk about the wet way and the dry way. And, you know, alchemy really isn't the most mundane thing that they were trying to do was turn lead into gold. It was really more about a transformation of the self. And the dry way and the wet way were – can't remember which was which. I think the wet way was the more extreme, but it might not be. But
it was the Chapel Perilous route.
Yeah, yeah.
I bet.
It was quick, and perilous versus slow and steady and guaranteed. Which I see, I see a parallel between
drugs and meditation.
Circle gets the square. So I think that there's something really to dig into in that. But another reason that entheogens were sort of a sexy idea to me is if you're looking at trying to find out a reason that liquid is so prevalent in these cases, sort of led me down that route because you have ayahuasca at once plant, god, and drink.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have ideas of eating the god, which I'm sure everybody's familiar with the idea that if you eat your enemy, if you eat their flesh, you can gain their power or whatever.
Yeah.
And eating the god is another variation on that, which is this idea that by eating a piece of the god's flesh, you can become closer to the god.
Communion.
Which, you know, is a lot of Christian communion tied up in that idea as well.
To coin a phrase.
Fun fact, by the way, my family priest was one of the proofreaders of this book.
What did he or she say?
Because he has John Keel on his shelf. So.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, Episcopalians for the win. So.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course he'd want to read it.
Yeah, exactly.
He doesn't care.
we Episcopalians try to not let the package hide the pudding, that's for sure. So,
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I think that there's something about, again, this idea of communion, this idea of sharing, communing with this other and ingesting and internalizing and co-create, you know, as a variation on co-creation too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Because that's one thing. Actually, I pulled a quote that I liked, and we did mention this earlier as the liquid thing. One of my favorite quotes was, let me find it. I've got a big list here of stuff I was going to ask.
If this is literally the sentence that I wrote for you, I'm going to flip my lid.
I don't know.
There's a sentence in here that I literally was thinking about you. Man, I've got some brown on my nose. Sorry, but
that's totally okay. I'm going to be gracious about it. I don't think it is, but if by accepting liquids from the entity, we're accepting of an extension of the entity itself.
Oh no, that's not it. Never mind.
Okay, what was the sentence though?
Let's see. Let me find out. It was this idea, which I've become. I wish there was some way to write an entire book on this, but I don't know if there is. But it's the paragraph under this liquid ET idea where I talk about the liminality of liquid between, you know, between solid and gas, and how you know, the physical solid realm and the gaseous spiritual realm, and how these phenomena, particularly UFOs, seem to traverse in and out of them, and how much sense would it make if we found out someday that this paranormal phenomena could navigate these phase transitions of reality, similar to the way in which water can be frozen or boiled.
Oh yeah, I remember that sentence. I didn't think it was from me or anything. Why did you think of me when you wrote it?
No, because it was it's the closest well, because it's It sort of reminds me of the UFO as cosmic art idea, in the sense that it uses a metaphor to quite thoroughly, I think, in the case of yours, in the case of this, explain some of the odder things about the phenomena. Because we always want to say, is it, you know, there's too much weirdness. There's, you know, UFOs seem to be able to harness and change and control reality. But at the same time, they leave burn marks in my yard. Well, I like the idea of this, you know, the idea of it, UFOs being somewhere in between the two and able to navigate those changes.
Or not, you know, care about them. It not even really makes a difference to them.
Yeah. It's like, do you ever watch Arrested Development?
Yes.
Okay. Do you remember Rita? Michael's girlfriend. It was a Charlize Theron, her character.
Who was a what?
Charlize Theron. It was her character. She was dating Michael.
Oh, Luther. God. Which season was that?
Oh, I think it was two. It was the Wee Britain. It was the Britain, the Mr. F storyline.
God, I can't remember. See, I was trying to think, because the first thing I thought of was always girlfriend. It was that woman that was in the Mexican soap opera. So oh, yeah. I think I remember.
Marta. Yeah, this was she
Hermano.
She plays a character, Hermano character. Charlize Theron plays this British lady, and Michael convinces himself, spoiler alert, that she's part of some sort of shady British conspiracy, when actually the Mr. F that she has on her bracelet actually stands for mentally retarded female. And it's revealed that, like, these things that he thinks are quaint Britishisms are actually because she just isn't developmentally, you know, fully fledged.
Yes, but I remember this a little bit. I will tell you something. The first time I watched Arrested Development, I think it was in Polish, because I watched it at work.
That's amazing.
So I had to actually go back and listen to the other tracks off work hours just to see what the hell was going on.
I bet that's a surreal experience.
It was. I mean, I saw Polish or German, or I can't remember, some like non-scheduled language that I can't even figure out.
It's like your own version of What's Up Tiger Lily or something.
Yeah, exactly. Except it's I can't believe you referenced that. You know, that's one of my favorite soundtracks, is the soundtrack to What's Up Tiger Lily.
I have an old soul, what can I say? There's this wonderful moment, because like somebody's talking about visiting in Britain, and she's like, well, why don't you just walk across the water? And at the end of this particular episode, everybody figures out what it is. And she walks across the pool, and she literally walks across the water. And for a split second, you think, well, maybe because she didn't acknowledge the fact that she would fall into the water, it has no power over her, which is where I was originally coming with.
Yeah. Kind of like flying in the Hitchhiker's Guide.
Yeah, that's a lot more succinct than me explaining the entire second season of Arrested Development.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. And then you realize that it's actually part of an illusion that Job has put together. Yes. But for a moment, this idea sort of like speaks to that, like, you know, maybe UFOs just don't care about your funny little laws that you have.
Yeah. I did write something on that once. It was something about, like, maybe UFOs are just like, you know, wind and waves and weather and all that happen and go on their merry way, and we put our own meaning on them. In fact, that's the only way that it can become something that interacts with us, is we start throwing meaning on it, and that engenders some kind of reaction that just, you know, engages with us.
Sexy idea. I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I never had that idea called sexy. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. You're welcome. Where's the anus?
Yes. That's the one T-shirt, and Twitter dress is the other one.
Yes, yeah. Hashtag Twitter dress.
But What is the meaning of that sentence if by accepting liquids from an entity, we are accepting extension of the entity itself? I know what it means. What do you mean by it?
This is an interesting thing, because when Red Pill was also an integral part of this process, and he read it and he really liked this idea. And I said, well, thanks so much for saying that you know you don't think it's out there and crazy. And he's like, oh, no, friend, I did not say that it was not out there and crazy. He's like, I think Stanton Freeman would read this and think it was a load of
Yeah, you'd have, you know, if he, I don't know, if he was that way, he'd have an aneurysm, which is good.
I don't think,
but for the idea.
Yeah, I don't think Red Pill even said that. I think he said something along the lines of like Stanton Friedman would read it and you know, sort of wouldn't get as much out of it, which, you know.
Yeah, psychological mumbo jumbo.
Yeah, but to me, this idea was tied in deeply to this idea of co-creation. Like, let's say that this is unknowable and that you are grafting your perceptions of what it could be onto it, meaning that there really isn't a spaceship there. There really isn't a gray there who really isn't wearing a jumpsuit and really isn't handing you a fruit drink. There is an intelligence there, but you are constructing all this around you. In that sense, all of this is made up of your perception. This is all entirely, not necessarily your projection, but like in terms of the objective reality, they're all the same thing. It isn't a discrete nuts and bolts spacecraft and a discrete cloth jumpsuit and a discrete flesh and blood alien and a discrete liquid drink. It's all the same medium of perception.
Mm-hmm.
In which case, the entire thing is an intelligence. The jumpsuit's an intelligence. The spaceship's an intelligence. It's all part of the same intelligence. In that sense, they're giving you a piece of themselves. They're allowing you to eat the god.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that's sort of where that line of logic is going. And that logic doesn't really make a lot of people happy. I'm not saying that's the way it is.
Let us entertain this idea and see how much fruit it bears.
Yeah. Some people, I've gotten some pretty pedantic feedback where people say that they don't understand that. I'm like, well, maybe this wasn't really written for you.
I struggle with that too. It's like, oh, you're, you know, is that elitist? No, I am going to discuss things with people who are either much smarter than me or at least slightly smarter than me and get something out of it. And if you can, great. And if not, you know, maybe we'll see each other on another subject. That's fine.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to like it, but as long as you think that I've articulated it, like I said, again, use that word lucidly,
yeah,
and that's all that really matters to me. And so it's a very loose concept. I mean, if you really wanted to simplify it, you could say, well, they're producing endogenous chemicals in the brain, and which is DMT, and they're giving you the entire medium that they're manifesting in is DMT, and they're giving you or ceasing that production of DMT by giving you this food. That's one way to look at it, although DMT isn't really a medium through which something manifests. It's a mechanism. But
right,
it's sort of tied up in that idea. That's sort of what I really wanted to say, but I knew I couldn't say that because it's not entirely accurate. But so it's the idea that you're seeing something that is – there are a lot of ideas in my book. At the end of the day, it's all paper and ink, you know?
At the end of the day, it's words, and that's all we have. And see if you can get the lucid idea that you're trying to communicate in those words, even if you don't exactly know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I've had some people, that's another great feeling is not really great. I really do appreciate when people say it, but like when people read your book and they're saying, I think this is what you meant. And they say it 1,000 times more succinctly.
Red Pill does that with me.
Yeah. He's really good at that. He's really good at being. Yeah. Yeah. He's really good I think what you meant to say is this. I'm like, yep. Yep. Keep on schooling me, buddy.
Yeah.
So
why don't you edit the next book? Okay, thank you. No, he wouldn't do that. I have two selfish questions before the tuba concert.
Oh, Lord. Yeah.
Okay, and these are like general questions I always ask. of all the stories in the book, what was the one that you just thought was like the most ridiculous, outlandish, stupid, I don't even know why I'm putting this in here, and why did you put it in?
Ted Rice.
That one was weird.
And not necessarily his, because I love his experience where he drinks something and he sees his soul go out of his body and there's this female entity that is projecting love onto him, because that's straight up I love the parallels between that and the ayahuasca experience.
Right.
I mean more of the
I'm talking about the dead grandmother thing.
Yeah. It's just it's not funny, but it kind of is.
Please repeat the story so people can be grossed out.
Banal thought it was hilarious.
but, oh, that's right. You were on Banal. I had to make sure I didn't ask the same questions. But I didn't
No. It's fine. Because like when I first appeared on Banal, I hadn't put in my 2 weeks notice yet. So I was kind of like, I kind of don't want to talk about reptilian anal rape right now. now it's fine. I'm all in. Ted Rice was sleeping with his grandmother.
What?
Well, not sleeping with his grandmother. He was in bed. Oh, Lord. He was – language. Isn't language wonderful?
Yes.
He was sharing a bed with his grandmother at his grandmother's house.
Yes.
And he was a recurring abductee. He was the subject of a lot of Turner's work. Right. But he recalls a reptilian entering his room while he's in the bed with his grandmother one night, opens his mouth, and gives him something that he described as a clear, maybe slightly yellow liquid on both of their tongues. Then according to him, his grandfather, who was deceased, walks in and starts making love to his widow in the same bed right beside him, which is already creepy enough.
Yes.
Then the grandfather finishes and dismounts and reveals himself to be a reptilian. Then several other reptilians come in and it's so awful. I'm just going to read this. No commentary. Rice was then forced to perform oral sex on the alien while several of his comrades had sex with the grandmother as well. The event ended with Rice being anally raped. Rice speculated that the liquid might have had aphrodisiac qualities, though he recalled no sexual stimulation. So it's this.
Why did you include that story?
Because
you could mention it on shows.
Yeah, I'm sure. My parents are so proud of me right now.
I bet.
No, they actually are. They're great people, and they are super proud of me. Because you can't talk about this, you can't talk about any of this stuff without bringing up sex and the sexual angle.
Yes, there's a whole chapter on it.
It's fascinated by this. Whatever it is fascinated by our reproduction.
So is Bigfoot.
Yeah, which is something that a lot of people don't talk about. But I knew that I was going to have that chapter, and that's, you know, I knew that people were going to ask me, well, maybe they're aphrodisiacs. So I felt like it was just, I had to include it, and I was looking for some material for that chapter, and, you know, there's a liquid administered and sex in close proximity. So that doesn't seem to be a huge trend. There doesn't seem to be a really strong connection between foods and sexuality. Of course, it's a little bit difficult to establish cause and effect. You know, if you look at it from another angle, you know, Antonio Villa-Boas, was covered in ointment and suddenly was able to have sex with a barking dog woman, you know?
Yes.
So I think that there might be something to it, but that's why it got in, why it was included. And, you know, this also had this idea, this article from Psychological Inquiry about male masochistic fantasies involving oral humiliation, I think is possibly has some importance to this as well. You know, foods being given, or, you know, as a way to, as a variation on that trope, because, you know, some people are given ball gags and given force fed liquids. So it's, you know, is that a BDSM fantasy enacting itself? Because
yeah, I read that and I was like, what the hell is that doing in an abduction scenario? A ball gag? What is this? Are we suddenly in a Tarantino movie?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. You know, he's thinking about doing a sci-fi film.
Oh, is he? Okay.
Yeah.
Now he's doing – I think he's doing – is he doing another Western, I think?
Hateful Eight, yeah.
Yeah. Just about to release that.
which looks pretty fantastic. I warmed up to Tarantino relatively late. I really have enjoyed his recent output. This sense that perhaps, well, I think that ties into co-creation again, you know? So,
yeah.
What is a ball gag doing in this? Well, maybe there's not really a ball gag. Maybe that's, you know, and not saying these people are lying.
We're not saying these people are lying at all. If you just say they're lying, why even talk about it?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, this is their truth. And like some of this, I may not be sold on the internal consistency of what they say, but, this is their truth. And like,
well, it's all elements in the conversation which you have started.
Well, right. You know, we're talking about the importance of the anecdote and how, you know, we can look at someone's brain activity and we can see something that might be causing them to perceive time as being slower than it is. But we don't actually know about that effect except through their anecdotal recounting of that.
Right.
You know, we can see the mechanism, but we can't see the actual effect, which I think is sort of akin to, you know, like, you know, a haunted house. Well, the anecdotes are there about ghosts and we can kind of perceive what might be an effect. Somebody was murdered there, but like, you know, so trying to cut out the anecdotal is
you can't.
Yeah, you can't. You can't. And so anecdotes have been diminished in modern scientific thought, but it's silly to do that because to this person, this is their reality. And who are we to say otherwise?
Yeah. Well, then it enters an area that isn't quite science anymore.
Yeah.
It's not even social science. It's you know, here's a category we're trying to throw on something. It's, you know, it's going in folklore somewhere, and it's going in autobiography somewhere, and it's going in cognitive psychology somewhere, and all these things.
Yeah.
I threw off.
No, that's fine. I think that is all I have to say about that.
Okay. We got through about probably three quarters of the things I had written down, and that's fine, which means we have to talk again, and we don't even have to talk about the book. We can just yak for 2 hours next time you're on about anything, unless the book comes out before we do that, and then we'll have to talk about the smelly book.
Yeah. The smell book, man. It's I think the reason that no one has tried to do this book is because it's way too much information to try to wrap your head around. But
is it really? Because when I first started reading Trojan Feast, it's like, well, how much of the literature could be filled with this? It's like, but then you start looking at it and how much it impinges on and how much it's related to and how deep the stories are embedded in many cultures, but specifically the Western, which we're talking about most of these things, it becomes a huge subject. I was reading, it's like, wow, he really had to pare down, actually. And you say that a few times in the book. It's like there's so much. A whole nother book could be written. You said a few times in there.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's the idea is where to draw the line. And, you know, people want me to talk about MIB Men in Black not being able to eat Jell-O, but that's not what the book's about, you know.
I didn't even bring that up. I'm sorry.
Wait, what'd you say?
I didn't even bring that up. I'm sorry. But you did mention that in the book.
Yeah. And it's like, I double checked the reference and there was not only the famous Richard French encounter, but there was an encounter that Valet mentions. One of these encounters is in 67, the other's in 76.
Yeah.
They're different locations, but again, it's this weird Jell-O motif, which I think, you know, is something strange. Men in Black just have a problem with Jell-O, I guess. That would have been hilarious.
If they're coming to your door, just throw Jell-O at them.
Yeah, basically. I would have loved it if Tommy Lee Jones in the film had like was seen in the cafeteria and he like slurps down. That would have been hilarious.
Yes.
Nice little in joke.
Little shout out.
Yeah, a little shout out, you know. But no, I don't think that they actually went that deep with their love of the subject. I would say that with the offerings of food and drink, I say if we could ever compile all the cases, it would probably be 1,500 or less, all the cases that are out there. Not counting a lot of like, you know, not counting legends and such. I'm talking about like actual like cases from UFO and modern fairy literature encounters. But with smells, like it comes to you unbidden. You know, you don't have there's not this exchange. Like, so I mean, like the number of cases that involve smell, I wouldn't doubt it if it was in the tens of thousands.
Huh, yeah.
You know, proximity is a factor with UFOs. If you see a light in the sky, you're not going to smell it. But plenty of UFO cases with smells. Talking about minor motifs, John Green said that only about 10% of Sasquatch encounters involve smells. But I, after looking at this, I have a hard time believing that that's the case.
Did you know a Bigfoot researcher told me that Sasquatch mimics people? I didn't know that till he told me. He said it's not publicly admitted, really, because it's so insane.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Well, you know what I would point to? I would point to, it sounds like a fairy thing. It sounds like this voice in the forest calling to you, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But the one thing that's become very apparent that I've heard, or a recurring theme that I've heard a lot is Bigfoot calling people's pets and sounding like the person, not necessarily because they're trying to lure in the pets, but like, think about it. Like, what's the loudest thing that you yell outside? You know, you're yelling your pet's name.
Yeah.
You know, Sparky.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The story they told me was that, somebody ran away from camp when they were out there Bigfoot hunting or whatever the hell it is. And during, they're out there yelling his name. You know, his name was, you know, Steve or something. Steve, where the hell are you, Steve? And then Steve showed up later. He had just gotten lost. There wasn't anything weird about it.
Right.
A few of them thought he was messing with him. It's like, God damn it, Steve. You know, and then later at night, they all went to bed and they heard this thing come crashing through the woods. And they thought it was Steve or somebody messing with them. They said the Bigfoot started yelling the same thing back at them.
Yeah, but here's where, and a lot of what I do is I could just try to take the piss out of people. It's something that I like to do. And here's what I would say to them is like, well, did you actually see Bigfoot yelling out of its mouth, Steve? No, I don't think a lot of people actually. Yeah. So, and okay, yeah, well, yeah, even if you saw Bigfoot and later you heard Steve, it's a pretty natural assumption. And I'm not saying that's not happening. But at the same time, we've noticed how these things like to cluster together in certain areas. So what if there's not a discrete separate phenomenon that's doing the mimicking and Bigfoot just happens to be, you know, hanging around?
That's genius. I never thought of that.
You can't take stuff like that for granted, I don't think.
Yeah. Tuba solo?
Sure. This is Tuba solo. Yeah, here we go. Okay. Give me a second. This is probably going to be, this might be a spot where you edit out, but I've got my earbuds and I'm going to try to figure out how I need to position myself.
Oh, so you're going to monitor it to see what the best sound could be.
Well, yeah,
it might
I guess.
Even be, you know, it might even be one where you have to point like away from the mic.
Yeah, I think
or
so.
Across
too.
It.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see here. Hold on. So give me a second. I'm taking my earbuds out, so I'm not going to be able to hear a thing you say right now.
Okay. That's fine. Here's where we say stuff that we don't want Joshua to hear. See, he can't even hear me. He's not even laughing.
Still can't hear you.
I will say when he's not online here that it's a great book and everybody should pick up a copy. People listen to the show will enjoy it. I started out not going well, and then he reeled me in. It's great. And this conversation just reiterated that. So as we wait for Joshua to get his I think I hear some musical instrument bouncing around.
Yeah. That's my valves. I'm back now.
I said nice things about you when you couldn't hear.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
And when you play the show back, you'll hear that.
So tell me what this sounds like.
That sounds perfect.
Really? Okay. Because I was afraid it was just going to sound like constant clipping.
No. It apparently that microphone likes it.
Okay. You know,
is that one of the first things you played?
What? Oh no, not quite. But I know that guy.
Really? Jim that played yeah. that in the for the movie?
Yeah. No community. I mean, I think even among musicians, the tuba community is a pretty tiny community.
Yes.
I'm actually on my sousaphone right now, but I'm going to do some shtick. I was, like I said, I was at the beach last week, so I've been back on the horn for like 2 days. So be gentle. Here we go.
I'll also turn off my mic, so if I laugh or anything, it doesn't show.
Okay, fair enough. Okay,
go.
Now that I know it's not clipping, we'll go for this. So.
Okay, that was the end of the first one.
Yeah.
That's the only one.
It might be the only one. I don't want to push my luck.
That's okay. Yeah, I did not know you could make sounds like that with a tuba, or if it's an artifact of the microphone.
No. It's all analog. It's analog tuba effects. There's a. I did my undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin, and there's a great band. If you like that, you should listen to this band, there's a great album. It's like one of the albums that changed my life. It's called Center Level Roar. 3 words, center colon level colon roar by Young Blood Brass Band.
I've heard of them.
They're fantastic. Nat McIntosh is a friend to acquaintance of mine. I mean, I guess if you've played euchre with somebody, they're a friend. But he pioneered a lot of these effects. A lot of what I do is out of the brass band tradition, and he's sort of pioneered DJ hip hop tuba playing, which incorporates a lot of these strange extended effects. And like, you know, I could have come on here, you know, but I just, you know, wanted to do something a little bit more interesting than something goofy like that.
Well, yes, I appreciate it. And the audience appreciates it. And you don't know this, but I am a huge fan of New Orleans brass bands.
No shit, really?
Yes. In fact, when I go to New Orleans, I've been there 3 times. I go to the Maple Leaf Bar to see the Rebirth
yeah.
play, and I've seen the Little Rascals brass band play and a couple others. And then, of course, you know, what's the big one that tours all the time that's been around for like 20-something years?
Dirty Dozen.
I've seen them outside of New Orleans a few times.
Well, my parents were good friends with the old Dukes of Dixieland. Somebody who's been a mentor throughout my life is Danny Rubio, who's the tuba player that they got to know. There's pictures of me as a child with Danny. And I actually came to tuba completely separately. There's a great moment. I got to hang out with their tuba player, Kirk Joseph, and Danny introduced me to Kirk, and it's tuba players are nice folks. And, you know, so you had an idea, like most people hear tuba and they think that it's going to be goofy, but like there's a lot of untapped potential here. So, got a couple of projects in the works. My old band is Half Dozen Brass Band. I actually got blessed. Well, we started out as 6 guys and, We I got the blessing from Kirk to name it that. It was sort of cheeky, but we sort of dissolved and we came back together. But we have 2 albums, which if you remind me, I would be glad to send you links to those.
All right, I will.
It's all first album's all original stuff. Second one's mostly original stuff. But my trumpet player was on Maynard's last tour, Maynard Ferguson's last tour, and was from New Orleans, and he's a great lead player, really talented group of guys. But we just life got busy, and I was doing books and booking and rehearsals and all this stuff, and it was just and writing and playing, and it was just too much. So I tapped out about a year ago on that band, and a couple months back, the guys came back and they're like, "Let's do this. We're going to delegate." And so far, so we're now rebranded. Their idea, not mine, rebranded as the Bigfoot Brass Band. So you know, sort of an idea of being a new beginning and taking the music in a little bit different direction. But yeah, so and I'm in a season of my life right now where I'm doing a lot of traveling this next month. So I've got two other projects that are lined up and ready to go. I just need to stay in one place for long enough. But one of them's like a Dr. John style voodoo swamp rock thing with tuba instead of bass. So
of course,
yeah. So I wish that a lot more people would use tuba because it can do some fun things.
As we just heard, do you have a brass band song that I might be able to find on YouTube to play us out so we don't bother your neighbors anymore?
Sure. You want one of ours or?
Oh yeah, one of yours.
Okay, let's see.
That's posted. I'm just going to search it on YouTube and get it.
You just search half dozen brass band, but some of them are from phones, and you don't want to do that. I'm trying to see if this recording of okay, so there should be one that's half dozen brass band at Henry's. That's the first one
that came up.
It's a pretty good recording of one of my originals. There's also if you want to do something more traditional, the Bourbon Street Parade thing is one of those. Suburban Street Parade, Bill Bailey medley. That's a good recording sound wise.
Oh, okay.
Well, maybe
we'll use that one.
We have a version of Big Fat Woman out there too. That's probably my go to when I want to show somebody the trad stuff. So any of those should suffice.
Okay. Well,
do you like half dozen brass band, Big Fat Woman?
I'll play that one. Josh, thanks so much.
Hey,
amazing talk, and I had so much fun.
Thanks so much. Yeah, it was a pleasure, and your feedback means so much. I really appreciate it, Greg.
No problem. I mean, great job. People should read this book. I have no problem recommending it. Can't wait for the next one. And if you do want to come on and talk again before that next book, I wouldn't mind.
Yeah, you just let me know. I'd like to think that I can rap about a lot of different stuff, so we'll see. And shameless plug, joshuacutchin.com is my hub for announcements and stuff, and I do some blogging, but I don't feel like anyone's really reading it that much right now. But we'll see. So if anybody wants to visit, start reading. Yeah,
it'll pick up, especially after this show, because I got so many listeners.
Heck yeah! No, this is one of the first things that I wanted to do. So I'm glad we got around to it.
So am I. Thanks for being patient for me getting back to you too.
Hey, my pleasure, Greg. Thanks so much. Have a great night.
You too. Thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Here, Big Fat Woman by Half Dozen Brass Band with tuba by our wonderful guest, Joshua Cutchin. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Here's a treat for Josh, because he said he wanted to hear it.
Make believe you're in a jungle movie. Watch the baby elephants go by. The beat is groovy. It's a brand new dance you ought to try. Come to the jungle and see the animal attraction, baby elephants in action for. The big bamboo beetle